Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Alexi Sale podcast. And we've got, the different things that we do here on this podcast are just remarkable. This was something that Talal was instrumental in setting up. So would you like to tell us a bit about who we're going to listen to today, Talal?
Oh, yeah, man. This has been a long time coming. I've been trying to make this happen. We've got Blind Boy on.
Blind Boy Boat. Race, club. Boat Face, Boat Club.
blind Boy Boat Club.
I've known him for years, but I can't, yeah. You know, one of the things about the Rubber Bandits is, I mean, he talks about this in the podcast, which we're pretending hasn't just happened. But, I was always a bit confused because I've known the Rubber Bandits, been to see them loads of times, because they're on stage with paper, you know, with shopping bags on their heads, and then you come off. So you're in the bar and you're talking to this Irish guy, and you think, is this one of the Rubber? You know, I've never really been sure who I'm talking to. Is this one of the Rubber Bandits I'm chatting to, or just some random Irish blokes? It's a unique kind of relationship in a way where you've just been watching somebody on stage for an hour, and then they use my name. They, you know, in the RA, used to put me in. Lexi Saley's in the RA, and then. And then afterwards, you're chatting to somebody, but you're not sure it's them. You know, it's a strange relationship.
And you want to, like, talk to them about their work and, like, tell them that you're a fan and all that, but it's...
Yeah, but you're not sure it's not just some bloke from Ireland.
But I do respect their choice to do that, to keep their own anonymity.
Absolutely. It's one of the many fascinating things about them. Anyway, so go on, you introduced this.
Well, yeah, we did have an amazing chat with Blind Boy. You're going to love it. But first, we've got to let you guys know at home, we've got another live show coming up.
Woo!
If you're in London, or if you can access London easily enough, on the 26th of August, it has now been confirmed, we're going to be doing a live gig, another small intimate affair. I don't even know if they've released tickets yet, but you do have to just keep googling it. I'll let you know on our Facebook and Instagram, Alexi Sale Podcast on both of those, and on our Twitter as soon as we have a new Twitter account, by the way, Alexi Sale Pod on Twitter as well. Go and follow us there, and any news, updates, things you need to know, ticket links, we'll definitely put them up on all of those. But it's going to be on the 26th of August at the Cartoon Museum. Now, one of the people who work at the Cartoon Museum came to our show at the Museum of Comedy.
And we only do shows at museums of various
things. It seems to be, yeah. And she emailed me a couple of weeks after that and said they would be really interested in hosting us at the Cartoon Museum because you, Alexi, have an interesting relationship with art and illustration, as you kind of touched on in the episode today with Blind Boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you illustrated one of your own books as well, just one of them?
Probably more. Great Bus Journeys. Train to Hell has got illustrations in it. Mm-hmm. Great Bus Journeys has got my illustrations in it, mostly Great Bus Journeys, yeah.
And the book you did with Oscar Zapata,
Zarate.
Graphic novel, Zarate, do excuse me.
Zarate.
Jeffrey the Tube Train.
Yes, he obviously illustrated that.
But you wrote it. And in that book, you also draw a graphic novel in the book, right? You're writing a kid's book?
I don't know. So long since I've
looked at it.
I should look at it myself.
Yeah, I remember there were a couple of scenes in your kitchen where you're drawing frantically.
All right, okay. There's also, when I had a column in Time Out, I would do illustrations.
I didn't know that. Mm. So for that reason, they thought it would be cool to have us there, and we accepted.
Yes.
So as soon as tickets are released, we'll share links on all the socials. But 26th of August, put it in your diary.
Yeah.
Alexi Sale Podcast comes to the Cartoon Museum in London.
And in November, the Museum of Knitting, and then...
then the Tank Museum eventually.
And the Tank Museum, yeah, that's true.
We'll do a jamboree there.
Mm.
So lots of cool, one cool thing to look forward to.
So let's get on with this podcast anyway, introduce it.
Okay. We're going to throw to Talal and Alexi now in the studio. talking to Blind Boy Boat Club Rubber Bandits fame. And of course, he has his own great podcast too, which you should all check out. Let's do it. All right. Thanks to Alexi and Talal in the studio. We're here with Blind Boy Boat Club.
Have you started referring to yourself in the third person?
I'm referring to the two geezers who threw to us for the interview.
Oh, that was me. Oh, that's, I see, right.
Me and you in a parallel dimension.
Okay.
So, okay, I started on a meta level comprehend. So I'm so grateful that Blind Boy joined us today. I've been a fan of Blind Boy and the Rubber Bandits for a long time. Me and my brother are big fans.
Thank you.
And
man,
I really thought you two would have a cracking conversation.
Yeah.
So don't let me down, boys. Go.
All right. Well, you can join in as well. But
Talal, are you Alexi's brother?
No, he's my new dad.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm the father. I was at your sister's wedding. When was that? Last Saturday.
Two Saturdays ago now.
Two Saturdays ago.
Yeah.
An honored guest.
Indeed. Yeah, Alexi's been part of the family for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I'm
very proud to say. And I've always felt a connection with him through the screen and in our brief meetings through the years. And now I get to work with him. It's lovely.
I'm your real dad. What's that Jim Carrey film, Cable Guy? Anyway, so yeah, we're talking with Tom Mayhew in the previous podcast. We were talking about my attempts to marry comedy and music, and I think that in the end, kind of in my own mind, failed. But a group that, you know, married fantastic music with comedy were the Rubber Bandits. And I don't know if you'd like to talk about that, really, how you got into that, and you know how that whole project started, I guess.
Thanks, Alexi. So the music and comedy, mixing those two things, it's quite difficult. First off, like we started off in school, like nearly fucking 20 years ago at this point, and making prank phone calls, and then it moved on to what you'd call musical comedy. But the thing is, like, we never considered ourselves to be musical comedians. Like, part of the problem is, what we were doing was so strange that when it comes to being professional and doing gigs, you kind of don't, the promoters don't know what to call you. So we ended up doing music gigs in comedy settings and theater settings. I never, like, my influences would have been Tom Waits, Randy Newman. Like, Randy Newman is a fantastic example of someone who is a musician and also uses comedy effectively. But one of the difficulties of using comedy and music together, like, we always said, we're not making comedy music, we're making music which sometimes happens to be funny. Mm-hmm. Because I took the music part really, really seriously. Like, I'm a multi-instrumentalist and a producer, and I care deeply about making the music. And the humor part, I don't know why this is, but sometimes when you bring comedy into an art form, for some reason, it seemed to devalue the quality of that art. And I never really truly understood this. It's like, as soon as novelty is the word that gets used.
Yeah.
Like, there's often words that are used within art critique, and I really disagree with them. One of them is satire. Like, let's look at what satire means. So what satire sometimes really means is, it's comedy, but it's for clever people.
Yeah.
And then within writing, you can have something like speculative fiction. What's speculative fiction? It's sci-fi, but for smart people. Then you have, what's the other one? Fucking magical realism within writing. What is magical realism? It's fantasy, but for smart people. And then with music, it's like, as soon as something, as a piece of music makes you laugh, people stop referring to it as music or art, and it becomes referred to as novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something I had deep issues with throughout our career, because as well as that, like a lot of, we were also influenced by Irish traditional music. Like there's no escaping that. And with Irish traditional music, humor is quite present in the lyrics throughout.
Right.
And so when we were billed as comedy musicians, it never really sat with me, but it's like, well, what are you going to do? This is the only way to get a gig. Mm-hmm. I think the only time we felt comfortable is when we started getting billed as a theatre act. And that was when I first started gigging like Soho Theatre, the Edinburgh Festival. Then all of a sudden it's like, they're neither comedy nor music. This is a piece of theatre. And then I felt a sense of comfort.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You see, I mean, because of your much greater commitment to musical virtuosity, and also because I was first appeared as a comedian, so it was also easier to dismiss my music as novelty music. And maybe I took a bit of that definition on myself and felt a bit ashamed, really, and which I shouldn't have done. I should have been more confident about it, but I wasn't really. So, but I mean, I think that you...
Were you a fan of people like Randy Newman?
Yes, very much. Yeah. Immensely. Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think like hip hop tends to escape that, the damaging fact of when it's funny? Because hip hop is quite inclined to have lots of humor put into it, but then people still take it kind of seriously, especially like fans of hip hop.
I would look at that as in, so the way I related back there to Irish traditional music, so within Irish traditional music, it's okay to use humor and this does not devalue the music. Also, if you look at hip hop, which is African American music, a lot of the roots of hip hop come from an African American tradition known as the Dozens, which is a type of taking the piss out of each other. It's like before rap was even a thing. And this, you can even trace the Dozens can be traced to times of slavery in America. And it can even go back further to Africa. And the Dozens was a way of using humor for two people to compete, basically a battle rap, essentially, except rap wasn't invented yet, to use humor to make fun of and take down your opponent. And I think this is why humor was seen as something quite acceptable within hip hop, but also it wasn't. Like, I do remember De La Soul, like they were a hip hop group in the early 90s who actively used humor, and they did, but there still was Biz Markie is another dude who was using humor in the early 90s. I don't think they were fully allowed into the canon of hip hop. You know, there's still, like, I often think of music, I think too, is like, music is symmetrical vibrations of air that cause you to feel emotions. It's the purest form of abstract art. And you tend not to laugh with music. I think music is it's a mating ritual, sexual thing. Like, that's what I think the purpose of music. Like, if David Attenborough was a Martian and he was looking down at humans and looking at what music is, it's something we use. Like, what do you do when you listen to music? You dance. Mm. And dance is the vertical expression of a horizontal desire.
Yeah, and that's where I always think, you know, as a stand-up, I lost out, really, because you can never compete with that, sexual.
Yeah, kind of pulse. And bringing humor into anything sexual, like, you can if you want, but you'll lose your boner, like. So, I've rattled my brains for so long to try and understand why, when you bring humor into music, does it seem to devalue the music and then it needs to be called novelty. Randy Newman is the closest.
Yeah.
He gave an explanation, and Randy Newman said, "Stop referring to what I do as songs. They're not songs, they're short stories."
Right.
And when Randy Newman said that, that opened up the world to me. And then I started to think, holy fuck, these are short stories.
Mm-hmm. But there is also that, there is also that thing that I think as a comedian, you always struggle against, which is simply that humor, because it is intrinsically subversive and disrespectful, that critics hate it, don't they? You know, because of those qualities, you know, real humor.
Yeah. Yeah. And you often find too, a lot of critics are attempting humor, but not really getting there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there are very, very good critics, but there's also critics that aren't good. And their way of, achieving humor is by taking shit down. And there's better ways to, you know, anyone can rip something apart and punch down at it.
Yeah, and also I think that, you know, I mean, one of the things the critics do or the kind of commentariat. Yeah, I'm trying to actually I was at the party last night. Now, this is I want to know what you think about this. I'm trying to launch a new phrase. So the people who comment are called the commentariat. I don't know how you feel about this kind of, these kind of definitions, you know, but people who comment in newspapers and so on are called the commentariat. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to launch this new, well, you know, I don't know if you know, but well, you probably do, but the kind of powerful elite in the Soviet Union were called the nomenklatura.
Yes.
Right? Yes. So I'm trying to now define all these kind of arsehole commentators, that David Aronovich's and every arsehole in The Guardian, as commenklatura. What do you think of that?
Commenklatura.
Yeah, do you think that'll
fly? I think they'll call you a communist.
Yes, that's well.
But with you, actually, that's one thing I'd love to speak to you about, actually, mm-hmm. Alexei, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as an Irish person, and I've got quite a lot of British listeners to my podcast, mm-hmm. and I speak frequently about the shame of British history and the shame of colonialism in specifically when it comes to the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I don't know enough about, and one thing I say to, I'll get British listeners coming to me saying, I'm only learning this stuff about my history now because mm-hmm. we weren't taught this in school. I didn't know what Britain did to Ireland. I didn't know what Britain did to India, to the West Indies. And I say, yeah, there's a bunch of that bad shit, but one thing that British people can be deeply proud of is the left-wing movements in Britain and how working-class British people were the ones who got us a lot of our modern working rights. Mm-hmm. Like, one thing I always say, because I don't like Winston Churchill, I think he was a fucking prick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because in Ireland, Winston Churchill is... He was genocidal in Ireland. There was a force in Ireland known as the Black and Tans in the 1920s who were, they were an elite military unit who were specifically designed to terrorize civilians, and Churchill brought them in. And what I always remind English people is that Churchill also sent British soldiers against striking miners in Manchester, Glasgow, Wales and Liverpool as well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
How do you feel about that? About, do you, because I don't know about the British education system, but do you think British people understand enough about the roots of working class resistance, things to actually be proud of about being British?
Well, the short answer is, I mean, no, really. I mean, I think that, you know, that history is been suppressed, really, hasn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. that the idea of, you know, the struggle of the British working class to achieve, you know, all those things. I mean, Linda always says that all those things that people trumpet about, like an advanced industrial state, like, you know, mm-hmm. education and healthcare, was not achieved by the ruling class giving us mm-hmm. those things, but by mm-hmm. the working class fighting to achieve those things, working hours, health and safety, that all those things are in fact achievements of the trade union movement and the organized working class rather than... Mm-hmm.
And blood was spilled.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, not to the degree of the foreigners' blood that we spilled, but yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I lived in a bit of a kind of a dream, really, that and the whole Corbyn years have been a tremendous revelation to me about how, you know, the ideas of socialism are completely unacceptable, really, now. Mm-hmm. That they weren't, mm-hmm. that they weren't in the, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, you had this, there was a degree of equilibrium that was the news department, say the BBC would always be reactionary, but drama would be much more left-wing, and you'd have mm-hmm. Ken Loach and and Mike Lee and all those people producing these plays. Yeah. Now the kind of censorship of socialist ideas is on something like the BBC is almost total, apart from me. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one who's still allowed to do. So, you know, I think that...
Do you find there as well that, like, because you're Alexei Sale, you're out there, you've been a communist for a long time, people know what they're getting with you. Do you think the fact that you've been there a while allows you that freedom to be left-wing in your views?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's because... yeah, it's because of that, because I've been in the entertainment business for 40 years and I've never, you know, really diluted my views. And so I've kind of carved out a position where I am allowed to say the things I say. But I think and that's great, you know, it's a nice position to be in, but it's I don't know if anybody knew would be allowed to take that same position, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. So in a sense, I'm a kind of a survivor from another era, really, you know. It's
what do you think, like, of people like Mick Lynch in terms of, like, I love Mick Lynch, but what I really love is he's inspiring a lot of people. He's inspiring a lot of young people. To hear Mick Lynch speak the way he does so clearly and concisely about workers' rights and to have that platformed and to see him ripping the shit out of commentators
and
that have been...
the younger guy too, Eddie Dempsey. I was going to mention
saw him, yeah.
They're basically spouting, like, Corbynism. Well, Corbyn is just spouting socialism, but, like, they are, you're right, they're totally inspiring people and their videos of them are really, really popular.
Yeah, I think that it's, I mean, somebody like Mick Lynch is an interesting phenomenon, really, because, one of the things about, despite Jeremy's honesty and decency, he wasn't particularly good at presenting himself. And I've always said that also having Seamus Milne, you know, a public school educated ex-Guardian journalist, kind of unapologetic about the Soviet Union in a sense, inflexible, mm-hmm. as your head of comms was a terrible mistake, really. Whereas what you see with somebody like Mick Lynch is somebody who's, I don't know whether he's either intuitively or he's thought about it. He's found a way to get around the bias of the, get around media bias and appeal directly to the viewer by being straightforward and honest. Whereas, you know, I mean, Jeremy had a tendency to kind of waffle in a way that, mm-hmm. And it's a real achievement. And I don't know what they will do to, you certainly, well, I suppose there isn't a strike at the moment, but you certainly, that one, the week of Mick Lynch, mm-hmm. you know, La Semana de Mick Lynch was astonishing, really. And you felt the commenclatura. Mm-hmm. Nah, it's not working, is it? you felt them reeling with this articulate working class voice and probably going away and planning how to counter his narrative, really. But
for me, with Mick Lynch too is like we live in a time where there's so much information that you generally leave most situations with a sense of confusion. There's so many competing narratives that you leave with a sense of confusion. Mm. And Mick Lynch had a directness and a clarity that you don't see anymore. And when you hear that, you're left with a feeling of safety and hope.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So we were also talking about, we shared a promoter for a long time, and you were saying you'd like to, you didn't. I think your partner in Rubber Bandits was at David Johnston's Memorial, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I met you, Alexei, in Soho Theatre because we mm-hmm. had the same promoter, David Johnston, mm-hmm. who died 2 years ago during COVID. And David Johnston, for me, was just a huge person in my career. When I spoke at the start of this podcast about not knowing where to position myself, not knowing, is this comedy? Is this music? David Johnston stepped in and said, let's call it theatre. I'm going to put you in theatre venues. And I would have been mid-20s at the time, and he was just a kind of posh, flamboyant Englishman who gave me lots and lots of confidence to kind of say to me, no, you do deserve to be on this stage. No, you do deserve to be at the Edinburgh Festival. because when you're a comedy musician, you're not getting a lot of respect from any angles. The musicians don't want you and the comedians don't want you. And that is a difficult position to be in. And David Johnson stepped in and said, no, you're deserving of this. And I'm just going to forever be indebted to him for the rest of my life because he gave me the confidence to have a career that I have.
Yeah, and he's terribly, I mean, Linda, I mean, my wife particularly was very close to him, really, and particularly misses him every day, really feels that, you know, it was lockdown. If anybody was killed by lockdown, it was David, really, because mm-hmm. it was somebody who was out every night, and then suddenly yes. he was stuck in his horrible little flat in Tufnell Park for like 9 months or something, and it just killed him, really, I think, you know, and there should have been some other, you know, way of being, I think, but it was just this. I can't imagine the torture of being such a convivial person as David was, and yeah. to be entirely cut off from everybody.
Very extroverted.
Yeah.
And he was also, he was incredibly generous because, like, he didn't make any money off the Rubber Bandits. You know, we weren't successful enough to make money, but he was like, if I want to make money, I've got Stuart Lee, I've got Alexi Sale, I've got these names.
Stuart's paying for all of us, but yeah.
Yeah. But like, we were not selling gigs, but he's like, I don't care. I believe in and love what you do. And if this means making a loss, then so be it. And wow. It's just that type of patronage doesn't exist anymore. And he was doing it for the love of the art, really. And
yeah,
it was just amazing to meet someone like that. Yeah, especially too, considering like I don't come from fucking big money, so I wasn't able to afford to go to Edinburgh. And then David Johnson comes in and says, I'll back all that. I'll pay for the venues. I'll pay for accommodation. Mm-hmm. If we make money, we make money. If we don't, we don't. But this is my risk and don't worry mm-hmm. about it. You focus on the art. And that was amazing to have met someone like that.
Yeah, and he contrasts that with, you know, fucking Avalon or Off mm-hmm. the Cab or any of those fuckers.
Absolutely.
You know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and yes, David, I mean, I think he's probably the last of a, you know, and I know that's why Stuart, you know, I mean, Stuart was really going to give up until he, you know, when he was with Avalon, I think, and mm-hmm. then it was only David that really rescued him, and now he's playing, you know, 6 months at the Leicester Square
yeah.
Theatre, the bastard. you know, and it's, I mean, that kind of, being a promoter for the good of the art is pretty, you know, pretty rare to non-existent now, I think.
Really. Rare to non-existent.
Yeah.
That's it. So it was just a pleasure to have that with him. And then also mm-hmm. too, the fact also is a huge amount of people who worked for David were women. And me at a young age, in my early 20s, that was actually brilliant too, because I'm like, oh, my stage manager is a woman. My lighting manager is a woman. And it was very helpful for me in an environment that tends to be quite male-dominated. So right. he did so much for me to open my eyes, to give me self-confidence. Mm. And the fact that I'm still here today is because of his input, I think.
Well, that's enough of a memorial.
Yeah, because I couldn't make it over to his memorial. It was the fucking height of lockdown, and I just couldn't make it over.
It was so amazing. There was a point... it was an amazing show that they put together, which it turned out sort of revealed right at the end he'd planned. But there's one point, there was some bloke he hated where we had to text cunt simultaneously to this guy, one of his enemies. And so he's getting like Stephen Fry and Kathy Lett and stuff. And then he's getting these texts from people just saying cunt. So that was one part of the show.
And I love how his funeral is a show.
Yeah.
It was perfect.
Yeah, it was. It was one of them great, and probably one of the last, you know, I mean, to some extent, you know, that kind of romanticization of old Soho, you know, that, mm-hmm. I mean, it's both, there's some parts of it that I kind of believe in. And I am, you know, the Comedy Store and then the comic strip were part of that mythology itself, really. And David, you know, I mean, David came to Soho at the age of 17 and then just mm-hmm. basically never left, you know, and, yeah. But there's some parts of that I also kind of find mawkish and sentimental, all that kind of colony rooms kind of stuff. But nevertheless, it was, I think, probably one, in a sense, one of the last flowerings. David's funeral was one of the last momentous events of that kind of old Soho, you know, which is now irrevocably changed, weird now. I think.
Soho's weird. Soho is weird now, and not weird in that good Soho way. Weird in that I don't know what the fuck this is. And you have all those sweet shops, those big American sweet shops.
Yes. Which remember we were doing the bike ride and we got hassled by a bloke from one of them.
Yeah,
we?
he was
creepy.
He was trying to like ride my bike. He wanted to have a go on it. Fucking asshole.
They reckon those shops are a big scam.
Yeah. It's
some type of tax avoiding scam. And they don't know.
And they're fronts for Afghani heroin.
Apparently so.
Yeah, they
if not Afghani heroin, money that was given to Afghanistan as aid, which is somehow being funneled out of the country via these American sweet shops.
And a bunch of them have been shut down recently.
Yeah.
Which sort of brings us on to your career now, Blind Boy, is that as a podcaster, full-time podcaster. I mean, I don't know whether you want to talk about how that came about or just jump into what you do now, really. So I'm interested in also in the, you know, the reach of it, that, you know, I mean, everything about it, really.
So, yeah, I don't really do musical comedy anymore. I don't do the Rubber Bandits anymore. I kind of look at that as something that I was doing in my 20s, because the other thing too is the energy of the Rubber Bandits is very much, it's a youthful energy. And I think being up on stage now in my 30s singing about fingering people would be odd, fingering at weddings. So what I did was around 2017, I started writing short stories. I started to write, and I have two collections of short stories that I've written and that I published.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided, fuck it, I'll start a podcast to promote it.
Right.
But now my podcast, it's got like about 1 million regular listeners. It's worldwide in a way that the Rubber Bandits wasn't. Like I did gigs in Barcelona, Madrid. I did gigs in Thailand. Like all over the place, because the reach of a podcast. Now, the interesting thing with how my podcast has such a large reach, I think it's because so many Irish people teach English as a foreign language.
All right.
Yeah. So you get all these Irish people who are English teachers living abroad, and they'd have students with quite advanced English. And then they say to them, well, if you think your English is advanced, don't be listening to Yanks. Don't be listening to Brits. Have a go at this cunt. So I get quite a lot of listeners that way. But I kind of treat my podcast as they're monologue essays.
Mm-hmm.
Each week I do monologue essays on whatever it is I'm passionate about and interested about.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done with it is I also have an academic background. I studied art and critical theory up to master's level. And that's one of those qualifications that's a lot of fun, but it's like, what the fuck do you do with that?
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been able to do is, with my podcast, I've got the years of experience of understanding an audience from doing like Edinburgh and Soho. So I have all that experience of understanding an audience and understanding how to communicate to an audience, and then bringing my academic background and passion for research and bringing them all together into a type of monologue entertainment, which is, I don't know how to describe it.
It's very unique. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously tremendous erudition there. And it's also, you know, it's one of the things I envy is that deep knowledge, which I don't have at all.
I found out as well that I'm autistic, so that gives me an advantage.
Right.
So where other people get distracted, if I think about something, I kind of can't stop thinking about it to the point that I forget to dress myself. But that's very handy if you've got a fucking podcast,
right? And it is very different to, you know, the average podcast, fucking the Richardsons or some bullshit. Was it Mary Shagavoy? That kind
of, yeah, and it feels like stream of consciousness sometimes. I'm surprised to hear it's like essay.
Yeah, so that's where. So when I mentioned there that the years of experience of like being on stage at Soho, learning how to put theatre things together, writing for TV. My job, basically, it takes me like 4 or 5 days to make one podcast with research, with writing. And then my job at the end is to make it seem like I just sit down at the microphone for 1 hour and speak. That's the entertainment part of it. Mm. So like with a fucking stand-up, you do a stand-up gig and there are certain people that go, wow, that was really clever. I can't believe he came up with that on the spot. And it's like, No, that's a joke that took a long time to write and a long time to test. And my job as a comedian is to make you think I came up with it right now.
Right.
So that's what my podcasting job is really, is to prepare, to write, to research. Storytelling is a huge part. My podcast always follows a three-act structure. And to make sure whatever I'm speaking about, that I'm telling the right story, but for the listener to think, fuck, this cunt just came up with this off the top of his head. That's the entertainment part, you know?
Do you see, because I mean, I've been having this kind of debate with myself really over the last few podcasts about the kind of the frontier, the borderline between entertainment and activism, really. And certainly, obviously, in your podcast, there is a very strong element of, you know, telling a different truth. I mean, a truth, really. I was listening to the one about the, it's just something, a subject I've always been fascinated with as well, which is, you know, CIA involvement in abstract art and also in avant-garde fiction, really.
Yes.
But I mean, where do you see what, I mean, do you have a, are you trying to achieve anything? I mean, are you trying to achieve political change? Or what do you think the objective is of what you're doing? Or is it just, I mean, is the object itself, really?
I wouldn't say, so if I do have an objective, the one thing I am passionate about is mental health. So when I speak about, we'll say, CIA involvement in abstract art, I would classify that as it's more entertainment. I'm telling a story. I'm making sure that I'm being ethical, that I'm sticking with my own political beliefs. I'm consistently anti-colonial. But ultimately, I don't view that as a type of activism.
Right.
The one part of my podcast that is activism and that I would see as political is when I speak about mental health. Because I, like in Ireland in particular, our mental health services are very, very poor. There's not a lot of investment in it. And people are, in my city, Limerick, the level of suicide is huge, particularly amongst young men. So when I do a podcast about mental health, I come at it from a position of responsibility and duty. Even though I kind of don't like it, because it's like, I hate the fact that so many people listen to my podcast for their mental health services, because they're doing this because they don't exist. The government aren't providing them. So that makes me annoyed that that's the situation. And also that dichotomy of, it's like I'm being a charity. Like, I love charities. Charities are brilliant, but there's also that part of me that hates that charities exist. That there's that continual, like, it should be the government providing for people. Nobody in Ireland should be on a mental health waiting list. Nobody should not have access to the mental health services they need because they don't have the money. And so I try to raise awareness for it to allow to the structural issues, but as well, because I do have, I trained to be a psychotherapist, but I never completed my qualification. I trained to be a psychotherapist for 3 years. So when I speak about mental health, I'm doing it with a degree of academic knowledge, even though I'm not qualified, but I speak about concepts from psychology in a way that I know would be genuinely beneficial to people. But I do it to a point where I'm not qualified, so I understand the boundaries of what's safe and unsafe in terms of what I speak about. And then when I get into territory that's unsafe, such as trauma, addiction, things like that, then I bring on an expert. So my mental health stuff, I would definitely consider there to be an element of activism there. When I speak about art, when I speak about history, that's entertainment.
Yeah, there was actually a bit, I was looking at something you'd done on YouTube, which rather gave me pause for thought, because you were talking about why you wear a shopping bag on your head.
Yeah.
And it's because you didn't want to be recognized. You didn't want to be stopped in Tesco's. But of course, the reason I became an entertainer is because I desperately wanted all that.
Okay. So you have a personality. Okay. So you have a personality where you're okay with recognition, or you're okay
I
with
thought that was, yeah.
But how do you feel about it now? Would you kind of like to have a plastic bag in your head?
No. I like being recognized. I mean, I've been able more or less to control it, really. And certainly now it's just fondness, I think, for me, really. So no, I don't think I would.
Yeah.
So
I'm built completely differently. I get, I love doing the art of what I do, but I have a history of social anxiety. So the idea mm-hmm. of being in a shopping center and someone even knowing who I am and needing to even coming up to say hello is the type of thing that would make me anxious. So
right.
I wear a plastic bag on my head so that I can separate the two things.
Right.
I'm blind by, and I make podcasts and I write books.
Yeah.
And like in Ireland, I wouldn't be hugely famous in Ireland, but I'd be like household name. Everyone would know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be well known enough that I wouldn't be able to have an uninterrupted pint. So I would not like that to be my life. The other thing too is separation of identity. There's a weird thing, Alexi. So I know what it feels like to walk into a room with my plastic bag on, and then for every single person in that room to know who I am.
Right.
Then I also know what it feels like to walk back into that room as nobody.
Yeah.
And those two experiences, what happens when people know who you are, you don't have to put in that work of, when you meet a stranger and you're just a regular person, when I don't have my bag on and I meet a stranger, I have to show that person that I'm worthy of their attention through empathy, through kindness, and then I can communicate. When I walk to that same person with the bag on as blind boy, I don't have to do shit. They know who I am. They have a preconceived notion, and then I'm not putting in the effort of empathy.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you certainly made me think about, my 40 years in the entertainment business, whether I think, you know, I say that I always longed for that. I always wanted strangers to, you know, bother me, really. So I guess that's, I wish I had that.
I'd be a lot more successful if I fucking had that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not, it's certainly not entirely healthy. I mean, you can certainly see that it is, it's a problem for an awful lot of people, particularly not just the entertainment business, but particularly in politics. I mean, that's certainly a really dangerous phenomenon, is that mm-hmm. desire to be well known and to be in politics. So I think it's a very interesting take on it that you have, really. So,
but this too, as well, is it's like, if you look at our industry as entertainers, Alexi, and you look at the amount of people who struggle with addiction,
mm-hmm.
or who struggle with mental health issues because of it, I think sometimes some of it is the desire. Like, we have a job where the amount of adrenaline you can get in one night is quite a bit. You know, you go up on stage and you do a good gig, the adrenaline and the approval from that is massive, and coming down off it is difficult. And some people can't come down off it, and what they need is substances to fill that hole.
Right, yeah.
Like one person, like Russell Brand, for instance, and Russell Brand is honest about this, but I know a story about Russell Brand. I think it was Noel Gallagher said it. I saw it on TV. Like, Russell Brand very, very much needs and wants fame. And he will say this. He'll admit this.
Mm-hmm.
When Russell Brand was really big in the UK, but nobody knew him in America,
mm-hmm.
he went to Los Angeles and no one knew who the fuck he was. Now, back in the UK, he was on Big Brother's Little Brother. Everyone knew him. But now he goes to Los Angeles and he's just some dude with an interesting haircut.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't handle it. So he had to go to Malibu, where all the English people were. And he just stood on a corner waiting for someone to come up and recognize him.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that shit to me is terrifying.
Yeah. And it's not normal, is it? It's not healthy in a sense. But as you say, he will at least admit to.
Yeah.
To that, won't he, really? I mean, I think a lot of that, I don't know whether it's age or maturity, but a lot of that has died in me. But I certainly had a degree of that, that I was unhappy when I wasn't in a place where or less happy when I was in a place where people didn't recognize me. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, how would you find that? So, like, because fame is so fickle, Alexi. So, would you ever find a situation where we say, okay, you're on the telly, you have a series, then you can't walk down fucking London without people seeing you or stopping you. Then the series ends on TV and you have maybe 6 months or a year of it being quiet. Then what happens is you stop getting recognized as much. How did you find situations like that, and did it affect your self-esteem?
Yeah, definitely. I think that I had, you know, I tend to, you know, kind of, divide my career into the sort of, you know, the, like Churchill, like the wilderness years, you know, and I think I probably talked about this in the podcast as well, that there was a period when I very much went out of fashion, really, I think, as a comedian, and I found that tremendously disturbing, yeah, made me very unhappy, really.
And then the question is there is, because I think with you, there isn't a huge separation between Alexi the human being and Alexi the person on stage. Those two people tend to be quite similar.
Yeah.
That then itself is dangerous, because there are entertainers, they don't have a plastic bag in their head, but they have a mask. Like who they are on stage. Who's a good example of that? Frankie Boyle.
Right.
Frankie Boyle on stage is not Frankie Boyle in person. Boyle in person is a very quiet man, but Frankie Boyle on stage is quite loud and brash, and they're two kind of different people. Have you found that Alexi the entertainer and Alexi the person are kind of similar?
Yeah, well, to a degree. I mean, I think that...
I can answer that.
Yeah, go on.
you're very different when you're not on stage. Alexi is actually...
Yeah.
He's not shy, but he's very quiet and composed. And... I think because when friends and family meet him, they're always like, wow, he's not who I was expecting. Because he is actually quite, he saves his words. He doesn't speak unnecessarily, and he seems very thoughtful and quiet and pensive when he's not on stage.
Yeah.
He's not that cartoon character that goes up on stage, especially in the 90s. His persona on stage now is more mature than he was in the 90s, but he's still loud and angry on stage. He's not that guy.
Does that answer your question? Yeah, I think there was a difference between the guy on stage and me, really. But where it gets more blurred is stuff like doing this or doing like the radio series that I've got, Strangers on a Train, which is going out at the moment. And that I do worry about giving too much of myself away. And I think I probably, you know, I think that that's definitely a concern for me. I'm starting, you know, bringing, you know, Linda into it, bringing the cat into it, you know.
Yeah.
It's that's a complicated area, I think. Mm-hmm. That's where I do have concerns, really, and that does make me uncomfortable, I think.
And that now is the norm, to be honest, Alexi.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing with podcast is what people are searching for is what's called a parasocial relationship. They don't necessarily exclusively view people as entertainers anymore. Listening to a podcast is an act of intimacy, and the podcaster becomes your friend, even though they're not. And people need more and more access. Like, I'm the same. I've got two cats. No, they're stray cats.
Mm-hmm.
They're called Silk and Thomas and Napper Tandy. And people all over the world know about these two fucking cats. They're just out my back garden licking their anuses. And I'm getting concerned messages about them from Brazil. And that's odd, you know.
Yeah, it's a complex thing, isn't it? And kind of a new thing, I think, in a way. And you're monetizing your cats, aren't you? You're in a sense, and
I'm monetizing them, but I'm the one who also feeds them. So there is an equality there. The food that they receive comes from the fact that I've mythologized them on the podcast.
Right.
We've always talked about this from the beginning of this show, Alexi's. Like, I've tried to sell you on how intimate a medium podcasting is, but I know that we are dancing the line between on how much you give away of yourself, like you said. And I remember the very first couple episodes; they were like 10, 15 minutes long, like tightly scripted material.
Yeah. And that's not going to work with podcasting, man. It's a different.
No, as it turns out, no.
Well, it really has. Yeah. It's become a lot more relaxed now. But I still think you do a really good job of not, you know, you do protect yourself well. You don't expose everything, but you do share just enough that people feel like they're getting to know you a little. But I do think you're doing a good job of protecting your personal life. I hope you feel the same.
Well, yeah, I think so. But it's certainly something. It's obviously like a lot of podcasters don't give a minute's thought to it.
No,
so
like Richard Herring talks about everything on his bloody show, from his testicles to his children. Yeah, it's a bit. Yeah, there is a ethical quandary there, isn't there, about how much you give away of yourself?
Yeah. So Blind Boy, this is your job now. Tell Al's eager to get some tips. Really, for what would you, do you have like any advice? I mean, what do you think about the business of podcasting?
Yeah. So my goal as a podcaster is to make sure I keep it as independent as possible. So my funding mostly comes from the patrons of my podcast via my Patreon. So the people who listen to my podcast are the ones who financially support it. And that's quite important for me, because I'm coming at podcasting from the perspective of someone who's worked in television. And with TV, the one thing I always fucking hated was you have this idea, you have this vision, you have something you want to do. And slowly but surely, what you end up with is a perversion of that vision, because commissioners get involved, directors get involved, and you always have to make these little compromises until eventually you don't like what you have at the end. With podcasting, I can do whatever the fuck I want. The listeners want me to... the only expectation that people have of me each week with my podcast is speak passionately about what you're passionate about. That's it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. If I start to get, like, I do have a certain amount of advertisers on my podcast, but my rule is, if you're to advertise on my podcast, first off, I have to be okay ethically with the company. Secondly, if you try and change my content in any way, you can't advertise with me, because that's what would happen. Like, I want to do, like, I might do a podcast exclusively on the history of pineapples. And I have done, and I loved it. And I went into the entire colonial history of pineapples and contrasted it with the potato. If I was being sponsored by a large brand, the brand could come in and say, no, I think you need to do one about Love Island this week, because we're paying for this podcast and that will get us more views regardless of the content. So I need to keep what I'm doing as independent as possible and listener funded. And I love that model. I really love that model, because, like, this is why I love public service broadcasting. Like, with any type of art or creativity, the most important thing is space for failure. You have to give creative people funding, not necessarily so that they get it right, but so that they can get it wrong a lot. And if you do that, then you can achieve greatness. But if there's financial pressure as an artist to meet certain kind of quotas, then you just reach for mediocrity each time. So it's just, that's what my Patreon allows me to do. Each week, I don't have any fear. I have space to fail. And that freedom means that I inadvertently succeed. But if I had some brand saying, we need 1.2 million listeners this time, then I'm going to go for mediocrity. I'm going to go, what's trending? Or fucking worse.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring on some horrible right-wing cunt so me and him can have an argument and platform their views, because, you know, having something people disagree with can bring views too. I don't want to do that. I don't want to have people on my podcast who have harmful views.
Right.
Yeah, well, we from an early stage said we're not going to have adverts on here. We rely on the patron as well.
For me, it's also because I was big in the 80s. So I don't have any, I have fewer financial worries, shall we say.
But true. As well, like, you also come from an era as well, Alexi, where, like, you know the phrase selling out?
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore.
Really?
That doesn't exist. The concept of it now... To sell out is just normal. It's to partner with a brand.
Yeah, especially
to
in advertise, podcasting.
Completely normal. Yeah. Like, it's crazy. It reminds me of like early television in the 50s. like even something as amazing as the Twilight Zone. Like I used to love the Twilight Zone. But if you look at old episodes, Rod Sterling, who presents it, will pause and then literally advertise cigarettes.
Mm. Yeah.
Literally. And then this stopped and advertising became a bad, shameful thing. And if you were to partner with an advertiser, it meant selling out.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as selling out anymore.
Yeah.
You kind of have to.
And it's a problem, isn't it? I think it's a problem for, you know, for our culture and our society.
Very really, much so.
That. Yeah.
Because I just want the freedom to, and I'm not, I don't even want to be controversial. I just want, I am a creative person and I want to explore my creativity and create art. And if I can do that, then I'm happy. But if I have someone telling me it needs to be like this, it needs to be like that, that's what I hated about television.
Mm-hmm.
The end result is something I'm now not proud of. The only thing I'm proud of is, was the initial pitch.
Mm. Right. Yeah, I think, again, I was lucky to work at the BBC.
So you had clout, Alexi. You've been there a while.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
I was talking to Adam Curtis about this. You know, Adam Curtis is, he will admit it, but Adam is allowed to just disappear into a room and make what he wants to make. But that's because he's fucking Adam Curtis, you know?
Yeah.
And you're Alexi Sale. You've been there a long time. So who's going to come down to fucking Alexi and say you can't do this?
Yeah, true, but it's this few. Yes, I don't know if there's anybody. I mean, Adam's getting on for my age, isn't he? A bit younger, but I don't know whether there's anybody, any younger person who has that, either that kind of clout or that kind of desire, you know, even that kind of concept in their head, that idea of selling out, as you say, really. I don't know whether.
No, it doesn't. There's people now in their early 20s, and if you told them even the phrase sell out, they'd be like, what does that mean? I've never heard it.
Yeah, yeah.
Any tips on raising, because we don't put anything into marketing on our show, but is there any advice of getting more listeners or more patrons? Because I wasn't anything in the 80s. We could really do more patrons, to be honest.
The way you just got to be honest with people. Be honest about what it is you're doing. Like when I speak each week, I let people know I'm an independent podcaster. This is my full-time job. This is what I do. What I say to people too is I try to have a model where I say, if you listen to this podcast, what you're actually doing is you're paying me for the work that I'm doing. So if you consume this and you enjoy it, please consider paying me for this work. However, if you can't afford it, don't worry about it, because the person who can afford it is paying for you to listen. So that's quite a nice ethical model. Mm. And for me too, like I literally have homeless people who listen to my podcast. Like people are homeless, but they have mobile phones. And I wouldn't like to put my podcast in a situation where they can't hear that podcast, especially when I'm speaking about mental health or critiquing the government's housing policy. So it's really a trust-based model, and I hope it continues, you know, and I hope I don't find myself in a situation where the only way I can continue is to be exclusively reliant upon advertisers who try and change what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And it's not even censorship. It's not like the thing you're saying is too hot. It's like, no, we think a podcast, we think 60 minutes talking about pineapples is insane. So you need to talk about Love Island. That's the shit I'm trying to avoid.
Your production with Rubber Bandits back in the day, and then like in the more recent years when you were releasing YouTube videos, they became quite mental health orientated. You had a couple of songs that were very much about mental health, but the production is so fucking good. And you said you're a multi-instrumentalist, but you didn't mention any training in that field or anything. What's your early relationship with music and creating like that?
So I've been creative for as long as I remember. Like the first songs I would have written, I would have literally been maybe 3 years of age. I was born into a family where like everyone was way older than me. Like, I mean, way older than me. My youngest brother is 16 years older than me.
Whoa.
So effectively I was born into a family of teenagers, and this was quite beneficial because they were all listening to Lou Reed and David Bowie and Bob Dylan, Kate Bush, all this incredible music.
Yeah.
And then I had another brother who was loved painting and loved art. So from a young age, I was encouraged creatively. And that served me. But anything, I'm self-taught, so I didn't.
Were there lots of instruments in your house growing up?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't instruments. There was a guitar. Actually, I was given a childhood guitar that I have strong reason to believe used to belong to Billy Idol. Yeah, because I had a brother who was going out with Billy Idol's like first cousin, because Billy Idol is half Irish, and there was this shitty little guitar in her attic, and they gave it to me when I was like 3 or 4, and the story is that this is Billy Idol's childhood fucking guitar. Whoa. So I learned to play guitar, I reckon, on Billy Idol's childhood guitar. So when I was like 15, 16, I started to, like, there wasn't like illegal software at the time, but people, kids in school who had the internet, the early 2000s, would get like different programs like Fruity Loops, these audio production programs, and I would get them I was looking for the Anarchist Cookbook, which was this weird little manual about how to make bombs.
Yeah.
I used to love that when I was a kid. But on the same floppy disk was software to make music. And I just put it on thinking I was playing a video game. But I taught myself musical production. And I taught myself, when I was making songs at like 15, 16, I'm like, I need a bass line. Well, I better figure out how to learn the bass. I better figure out how to do this, how to do that. And illegal downloading was a huge help to me as well, because I obviously couldn't afford a lot of the software I was using. Mm. So I illegally downloaded it. I know that's unethical, but now, because I make money from it, I pay for the software. So it worked in that roundabout way. I've always loved music. I adore music in every way possible. And I love creativity and art. Like, I also was a painter, and writing. If it's creative, I'm doing it. If it's not creative, I'm not doing it. Like, I failed in school. I was expelled from school. I was terrible, terribly behaved. I now realize it's because I was autistic and I didn't know it. But I'm just lucky that I was able to, that I can earn a fucking living out of what I do.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I consider success to be. Success to me is, can I earn a living doing what I love? And if I can fucking do that, I'm successful. It doesn't matter how successful the work is.
Absolutely. Did you have that PlayStation 1 game where you can make music and you can put your music CDs in it and take samples?
So I had something similar. I do remember it. I had the equivalent, but it was on the computer. It was called Hip Hop EJ. So it was the same as that PlayStation game. And again, I was there putting music together. I didn't think what I was doing was creativity. I thought it was a video game.
Yeah.
But actually what I was doing is I was teaching myself how to produce without knowing it. And that was actually good, because when the best way to create anything is to be in a state of play, whatever the fuck it is, writing a book, painting a picture, making music, if you go at the creative process with this concept of I'm creating art now, that's that adult way of thinking. That's that school. Like, everyone as a kid played with crayons. Yeah. Everyone played with Lego. Everybody. And then you get to school and someone says you're good and you're bad.
Yeah.
At doing this.
And it stops being play.
It stops being play. Yeah. So when I first started producing music, because I didn't think what I was doing was creative, I thought I was playing a video game, that actually expanded my consciousness to doing this. Because when you're playing, there's no such thing as good or bad. You're just playing.
Yeah.
Like with Lego. Kids, if you look at a kid playing with Lego, they're not necessarily trying to make something good or bad. They're just exploring Lego. And when you can approach the creative process in a way that's explorative and playful, then you'll unlock your unconscious mind and you'll have crack. But if you're critical, fuck it.
Yeah.
Do you still live in Limerick?
I do.
Does that sustain you?
Yeah, so that's another thing. Because I don't come from fucking money, like, that's another problem that's happening too as well today, Lexi, and you'll notice, like, you come from a working class Liverpool background. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't see a lot of that today with comedians or musicians. A lot of the kids coming up now tend to come from kind of generational wealth. So then what happens is you don't have entertainers who are coming from a perspective of a working class background, especially in the UK. So I stayed in Limerick because the only way I could pursue creativity and have all this space for failure was if I stayed in fucking Limerick, where the rent was really, like, Limerick is a poor city. It was particularly poor during the recession, but it meant that rent was fuck all. I should have been living in London. I should have been living in Dublin. I would have had a lot more opportunities, but I couldn't afford it. And then when I was in London, in Soho, a lot of the people my age who were gigging, they were doing it because they had someone kind of, their parents or whatever, funding them to live in London.
Yeah.
Like, what about that? Surely you noticed that, Alexi.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I used to a bit. Yeah, well, there's not only there's the wealth, you know, there's not only the wealthy, but there's also the sort of, there's then on top of that, there's the children of my generation of entertainers who have become entertainers themselves, really, because they've obviously got a very smooth path. Mm-hmm. They haven't just got money, but they've got connections as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, fair play to, like, Rowan. I know one of Rowan Atkinson's kids joined the army. And I just think, well, you know, well done you, really, rather than becoming another fucking second-rate comedian, really. I think the fucking Alistair Campbell's daughter.
Oh, yeah. Doing stand-up. Gross.
But, yeah, so it's, I mean, there's several different, yeah. You know, there was a golden age of where, you know, you got full grants and you got, you know, if you're working class, allowed
anymore.
To go to university and all that shit. And it's all gone now. And it's, again, it's a tremendous problem.
Would you mind telling me a bit about that, actually, Alexi? Because that's the shit, like, we don't hear about, all we hear about Britain in Ireland, really, is that Britain are a load of cunts. And, like, but, like, because, with, like, colonialism, but, like, one thing I've always been fascinated by is, like, when I look at the artists that I loved from the 60s in the UK, like, they all went to this thing called art school. Like Bowie or John Lennon, half of Pink Floyd. And you had, like, the Kinks, who were working class artists, they went to art school. What was that? What was that, like, the access that working class English people had to all of a sudden be like, I can study art now and I'm 17 and I'm going to start a band and this is okay?
Well, I think it was essentially, it came from the 1944 Education Act, that even before the war was over, there was a kind of consensus that we had to have a different world, really, that this was a once in a lifetime opportunity.
And this is where the NHS came out of this too.
Both the NHS and modern British education, all those things came out of, you know, planning, which was already going on before the war ended, really. And also because I haven't studied the details of it, but also I imagine because the forces were radicalized by having fought against fascism, but also I think for the first time, you know, you don't, as a working class person, you don't really come into contact with the ruling class. But I think for those years of the war, the soldiers would have come into direct contact with the ruling class, because with their officers, and would have seen what a fucking bunch of cunts they really were. And so I think the armed forces were radicalized by that exposure to, you know, both through fighting fascism, but also through direct contact with, you know,
Have someone who's conscripted effectively, and now they're speaking to their commanding officer, and this is the first time they've ever spoken to a posh person.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, I mean, this is a theory of mine, really. I don't know whether it's borne out by any kind of research, but it seems to me to be...
Wow.
Yeah, obvious, really, that was... And, you know, because it was literally life or death as well. So your life was in the hands of this kind of idiot, either a brave, you know, caring individual, or more likely a kind of idiotic toff, really. And then the further up the power structure you got, the less and less caring of your life the structure would have become, really, the high command.
Because thing I always think about there, Alexi, too, is Neville Chamberlain. So the first council houses that were built in Britain, I think it was around 1917, and Neville Chamberlain was the one who brought this in. And I was thinking, wow, that looks good. But then I looked at the reasons behind it, and Britain they did a report on the health of the soldiers, British soldiers in World War One, and they found that British soldiers from working class backgrounds were less healthy and less effective than their counterparts in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
So Neville Chamberlain said, okay, we better give them better access to sewerage and housing so that we can have better cannon fodder for any future wars.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's what I always, you know, I mean, there's a kind of Marxist analysis of history tells you also that the reason that we have health and safety regulation or the National Health Service or an education system is not effectively really because of altruism, but simply because it makes you a better, more effective industrial state, really, that if you've got an educated workforce that's healthy, you're going to be theoretically better at producing consumer goods. So none of it's about altruism. And there's a kind of I sometimes wonder, really, that thing that we were talking about at the start about how the unions achieved, you know, health and safety, education, blah, 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 whether they, in a sense, weren't doing the capitalist job for them. I don't know. It's a, it's a kind of complicated area. Anyway, so 1944 Education Act, I think established, again, I've not formally researched this in any way, but my understanding is that it set up a system of state schools, but also of further education, further and higher education. So you would get colleges, polytechnics, and universities, but also that you would be able to get, anybody was entitled to a grant which would pay their fees for 3 years, but also would pay their living expenses. So when I went to art school in the, for 5 years, my fees were paid. And also when I went to Chelsea for 3 years, all my living expenses were paid.
Wow.
Damn. I mean, incredible, really. I mean, and we're kind of, you didn't appreciate how lucky you were.
But how important was that to you, Alexei? Because, like, you didn't just arrive one day and decide, I'm going to be a successful comedian. That's a journey, and that journey requires a huge amount of failure, and it also requires free time for that failure to occur.
Absolutely, yeah, and yeah, certainly my time at Chelsea was a kind of rollercoaster ride of quite a lot of failure. But yeah, it was all subsidised. You know, I never had to. I had like a materials allowance, canvas and paint, and you know, I mean, everything was paid for, really. And it was an extraordinary golden age, you know, that produced, you know, like you say, particularly in rock music, because what you got from art school was this kind of art school way of looking at things, which was to say that everything was as valuable as everything else, you know?
Yes. Like when you listen to like Bowie speak about his work, he's not speaking about it as a business. He's bringing ideas from Dada. He's bringing ideas from theatre. Bowie's thinking like an artist, thinking like someone who has a formal art education.
Yeah.
And that's essential to any type of creativity. Like with stand-up too.
Yeah.
It's not just stand-up. It's an act of theatre. It's entertainment. And you can borrow from any other art form and bring it in.
Yeah. Well, that was very much, I mean, that's what was very much my approach. And it's something that, you know, is, I think, again, sadly lacking these days. Obviously, that in my stand-up, there was ideas about architecture and social justice and, you know, interior design and stuff. Whereas now you're most, I mean, again, you kind of, it's not the mother-in-law anymore, but your kind of average comedian has reverted to my girlfriend did this and my girlfriend said that. And it's kind of fucking banal shit, really. But yet it was an amazing, and then not only was that, but later on I became, the 1944 Education Act also specified that there was an interesting thing, I think, and again, I have no formal knowledge of it, but you had these network of art schools in Britain, and so every little town would have one. Like not only would Liverpool have one, but Bootle would have one, Formby would have an art school, and as well as teaching the fine arts, they would also teach things like wood graining, craft, working class craft subjects, bookbinding, you know, anything where there's a kind of line between craft and art, really, that they would teach working class kids and working class apprentices these skills, really. But they'd be taught in an art school context. So a lot of like Bootle Art School would do wood veneering, wood graining, shit like that, really. Decorative sign writing was another thing. I mean, that was, you know, that straddled the line between craft and art, you know, really interesting kind of stew, a kind of confluence of ideas, really. So, you know, you would, yeah, you'd be doing, you'd be doing, like, you know, so you'd be being taught how to, you know, do sign writing for butchers' shops, but also you might, you know, that would involve kind of ideas of ethics and aesthetics and, you know. So the impact
on your immediate environment of your sign, thinking about the sign not as just something that speaks about a butcher shop, but something that services the community.
Yeah, and it's got an aesthetic value and stuff like that. Exactly. And all these tiny little colleges and these tiny little industrial towns were teaching this shit, you know, but then
what that does for the confidence of the person who, they might come from a working class sign writing family.
Yeah.
And now it's, I'm not just doing that thing my granddad did. This is actually art. And my granddad was an artist and I'm an artist. And now I can think a lot bigger with a lot more passion about this thing that I'm doing. This is creativity. It's not just a trade. It's creativity.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, a lot of those, because the other thing that happened in 1944 Education Act was that this thing called General Studies, which was that apprentices were supposed to have an, if they were on day release at college, they would get an hour's general studies, which was kind of ill-defined kind of cultural studies. Or if they were on block release, where they were in college for a week, they would have an afternoon of cultural studies. And I actually, it was both a way of teaching apprentices about cultural matters, but it was also a way of subsidizing kind of ill-educated art school graduates such as myself. So I actually taught general studies for several years. And that was, I taught at a place called London College of Printing. And that was where it was, I taught like the last generation of bookbinders, working class bookbinders, where bookbinding was going from being a working class apprentice-based trade to being entirely something that was taught at the Royal College of Art to posh people. And you could see that change happening, really. And it's, again, it's...
And your interest in communism, Alexei, were you also looking at how the Soviets used art? Like the Soviets didn't, they wanted to remove the boundary between, we'll say, the public and the art and make everything as one. Like even at the start of the revolution, they would get factory workers who would do a play. They, like all the factory workers together would do this giant play that involved the factory. And it was a way of using art and storytelling and creativity to get people passionate about working.
Yeah.
Were you looking at...
Man with the movie camera, the film.
Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was... I was very aware of all that, really, but also aware of how... That was betrayed, really. That obviously all those, the constructivists, and all those workers' theatre groups and, where a lot of them were actually executed, you know.
Yeah, and then the ones that survived became mouthpieces of the state to create Soviet realist art, which isn't particularly interesting. Did you hear that you mentioned earlier, I was talking about the CIA and abstract art. How did you feel about... So like in the Soviet Union about the 50s and 60s, you had the Yanks basically were trying to communicate to Russia, you cannot exist as an artist in Russia because the state has too much control over what you do. Look at us here in America. You can piss on a canvas and call it art because we are free.
Yeah. Well, you know, just to a degree, they were kind of right in some senses.
To an extent,
you can't,
I mean, the artists didn't know that they were doing it, but the CIA were basically going, we also need state-controlled art, but we can't have the artist knowing that it's state-controlled.
Yeah, and then that again, that becomes a whole more complicated. I don't know,
because one argument, Alexei, is so the Yanks did this with visual art, but one critique is that the CIA also got involved with how literature was written in the United States. And one thing in particular that they pushed writers towards by funding the colleges that are teaching people how to write, they pushed writers towards heavy use of metaphor and in particular show, don't tell. So if you are writing, make it vague and make it something that's quite open to interpretation. But the CIA were going, don't be direct. Don't literally tell people this is what your art is about because that's too political and that's too dangerous. It must be open to interpretation. Like, they bought the script of Animal Farm. You know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so this, the CIA purchased the movie rights to Animal Farm because they were terrified that it was too critical of capitalism. So
any, really?
Yeah, so it, when Animal Farm is portrayed on screen, the CIA are the ones who own that.
Really? Because it's a pretty... they made it into an animated movie, which was kind of...
Yeah, they did. Basically, they changed the bit that was like, can you make communism look terrible?
But yeah,
well, any bit that critiques capitalism, take that bit out.
Right, right. That's really interesting. That's, I mean, actually, mind you, Orwell himself was a snitch with the security services.
So, was he?
Yeah, no, he compiled a list in 1946, I think, of people he said were... communists, I think, at the BBC, and passed it to the security services. Yeah.
Actually, that's something I must ask you about, Alexei. So in America, it was quite open that, like, in the 50s in particular, communists were just, they were not allowed to have work. You had John Wayne, I think it was. There's a brilliant film called Trumbo. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
About Dalton Trumbo, yeah.
Yeah. Was a similar thing happening in the UK? And how did it feel for you coming out in the early 80s to go, I'm Alexei, I'm a communist?
No, I think that that's one of the things that, you know, I mean, patriotism is a complicated issue, really, but it is one of the things that I felt proud to be British about, that wasn't a problem. And I think it's one of the things that I mourn now, because I think Britain has become a much worse place in that regard. But obviously, a lot of people, I mean, not Trump, but a lot of people, a lot of victims of McCarthyism fled and came over to Britain and found work, particularly in left-leaning TV companies like Granada and stuff. And, you know, there are a lot of that. They wrote things like Robin Hood and Ivanhoe, those early kind of 50s, which do contain, if you look at them, you know, do contain anti-capitalist messages, which they would secretly insert. So I think that a lot of Joe Losey, a lot of people who fled the witch hunts in the States, came to Britain and found a very welcoming atmosphere, you know. And it was also, for me, it was also, you know, I risked nothing by coming out and saying I was a Marxist, coming out and saying I was the child of communists as a stand-up in the early 80s was a positive, you know. What a brilliant commercial, you know. And it was, like I said, I was big in the 80s. It was commercially, I was commercially successful, and I was, you know, artistically successful. And that was, you know, the ideas that I propounded when, you know, anti-colonial ideas and stuff, when vilified in any way, it was, you know, and that was, I thought, well, this is what a fucking
if
wonderful
country. If a comedian said that
is.
Now, like, I think of that activist Ash Sarkar, and she came out on TV and said, I'm literally a communist.
Yeah.
And people's heads went on fire.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. Well, it was like, it was, everybody in the BBC drama department was a communist.
Well, the 80s was a time
in the 70s,
The 80s was a time of activism and of real social change and people thinking about
But all
about
that was gave you was a kind of healthy balance, you know. It didn't, the left did not in any way control things, but at least there was a kind of, those voices were allowed to speak, and now that is not the case, and something profound has been lost in Britain because of that, I think, you know.
Are the roots of that within Labour? Did Tony Blair start that shit?
He certainly. I mean, it's questionable whether the Labour Party was ever really a voice, you know, was ever really a vehicle for genuine change. I think, in a way, you know, I've always thought that the Labour Party was a device to stop socialism, not enable it. Ultimately, but I mean, obviously, Blair took it to a whole new level. So you know, but it was just culturally, Britain was just this amazing kind of free. I mean, not, you know, there was still like trade union activists. There was still a blacklist. There was still the whole spy cops thing, with, you know, as
there was still everything that happened in the north of Ireland. Which
and yes, exactly. And that was like, you've always got to say. You've always got to say, except in the north of, you know, in the north of Ireland,
always,
where government death squads were operating. You know, I'm talking about this wonderful time of the 70s, but there was, you know, it was like you said as well, there was massive collusion between the British security and military intelligence and loyalists, you know, and they killed hundreds and hundreds of people.
I found out something, a crazy fact recently that I'm going to do a podcast on. So the collusion there, right, of where British military officers in plain clothes in the north of Ireland were literally murdering civilians. And they were murdering civilians of both sides, specifically to start sectarian conflict.
Right.
So that the north of Ireland could be portrayed as uncontrollable.
Mm.
It's start a sectarian conflict and then you bring in the British soldiers and you go, this isn't about Britain. Their paddies are just crazy.
Right.
So what I found out recently was one undercover soldier who was masterminding this, his name was Robert Nyrack. He was killed by the IRA. He trained the Kestrel in Kez.
Really?
So the Kestrel that Ken Loach used in Kez, he borrowed it off Robert Nyrack when he was a teenager in private school who was keeping Kestrels. So the Kestrel in Kez is somehow horribly involved with state collusion and the murder of people in the north of Ireland.
Fuck me.
I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah.
I nearly shat myself when I found that
yeah,
out.
Yeah. It's, man, it's all
I need Ken, I'd say Ken, he must know. He has to know.
I don't know, I'll tell him if I see
it's
him.
It's like do finding please, out will you? That Flipper used to be trained by Mussolini or something.
Yes. Now, I must say, Ken Loach, this was before Robert Nyrack became like a military spy. Mm. He was like a teenager, but still.
Yeah.
It's like, of all the Kestrels to train, of all of them, it's in a fucking Ken Loach film. Come on. And then Ken Loach goes and makes The Wind That Shakes the Barley about British violence towards Ireland.
Yeah,
ridiculous. Yeah.
It's well, it's, maybe it is all connected. You do sometimes think that, you know, some level is there. You know,
well, one thing that was like in the '70s and eighties in Britain, MI5 did fund quite a lot of left wing shit, in particular magazines.
Mm.
I know that MI5 funded magazines that were directed at the Afro-Caribbean community.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. I know they funded earlier Encounter and stuff, magazines.
Yeah.
Poetry magazines and stuff.
And the goal was, again, it was to promote the illusion of freedom. So they would fund magazines for people of an Afro-Caribbean descent. And it was about celebrating their identity, celebrating their blackness, but celebrating within the context of capitalism. And
right,
anything that was socialist, pan-Africanism, that was to be pushed out. So MI5 were like, well, we can control this narrative by making sure the money comes from us, but they don't know where the money is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's often a key. Like the one thing I find strange about intelligence services is they just put their money to get involved in shit just so they know what's going on and to control it.
Yeah.
Like the way that, the CIA most likely helped the IRA bring guns from the United States to the North. And you're kind of thinking, why? Like, America is an ally with Britain. Why would the CIA help the IRA get weapons? This doesn't make sense. And then you go, the CIA helped the IRA bring weapons because if they didn't, then it might be the Russians. And then if it's the Russians, then you've got the IRA getting very communist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know it's going to happen anyway, so you might as well have a part of it.
We can't stop this, so we're just going to get involved. And you see the same shit with the Middle East. Like if you look up, you look at like I remember it during the time of Obama. I'd be looking up different, we'll say militants and insurgents in Syria and Iraq, mm-hmm. and the ones that are actually funded by the US. And they're proper jihadists.
Mm.
Like they're literal jihadists. But it's like, but they're our jihadists.
Well, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that both the American security services and the Israeli security service were instrumental in facilitating the rise of Hamas in the...
Oh, yeah.
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 Big time.
Yeah.
Oh, everybody knows that. I thought you'd be impressed with that.
I'm impressed with that.
They're not about stopping anything. They're about how can we get involved? Like,
yeah.
I heard someone describe the CIA recently as the criminal wing of not the United States government, but the financial interests of the United States government. And that's what the CIA are. They're the criminal wing because what they do is criminal.
Yeah.
Consistently.
Yeah.
How they topple governments. Like, fuck me. What mad shit did they do?
Yeah.
In the Philippines, there was an uprising in the Philippines in the 50s, and the CIA found out that the folklore of the Philippines, people were afraid of vampires. So in order to stop the equivalent of the Filipino IRA, the CIA would go in, kill a lot of people, drain the blood from their bodies and hang them from trees.
Fuck off.
And then the insurgents would think that vampires had attacked them, and this fucked up the whole network.
Are you kidding?
Similarly, MI5, man, in the north of Ireland in the 70s, whenever there was a shooting or a bombing by the IRA, MI5 would sneak in and start putting upside down crucifixes and candles everywhere.
Really?
So, yeah. So anytime there was IRA activity, they'd put satanic things there. So it was MI5 trying to communicate to the population that this is satanic and you're really Catholic, aren't you? So these people are not your heroes. They're secretly in league with Satan. And they were doing shit like this. It's mad.
Well, they are, yeah.
That's not conspiracy theory. That's literal conspiracy that we now have
evidence
for.
Yeah,
because I don't like conspiracy theory, because conspiracy theory is like, it's like a collective fiction we're all writing at the moment. But when you look back at stuff that's actually released, then you go, holy fuck, these cunts are mad.
Yeah. Well, that's also true. They are, I mean, they're disturbed individuals.
But they pick disturbed individuals.
Yeah.
Like one thing that always bothers me when I speak to the way that the squaddies go around to schools in the UK and they specifically pick out kids that are bullies, you know, or they pick out the kids that are very disruptive and they say, come on here and be a squaddie with us and you can do that shit somewhere else, but we'll give you a ribbon for it.
Yeah.
Picking out kids that are traumatized and in need and angry, and instead of addressing their trauma, saying, you don't have to be drinking on a Saturday night, glassing someone in the face. You can just do it in Afghanistan instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I find that shit really, that fucks me up.
Yeah. Well, it's done under the pretext of giving them a kind of a structure and a kind of, you know.
Under the pretext.
Kind of meaning. Yeah. Well, the British, I mean, the British Army is something is, you know, it's the oldest organization in the world in some ways, isn't it? Certainly, because it's an organization that has learned how to organize groups of men, but over, you know, since certainly Cromwell's time, you know, it's consistently been operating as a kind of a coherent organization with aims and objectives since the time of the English Civil War, really. And so it's a sort of, it's a fascinating organization in itself, I think.
It's fascinating, but the insidiousness of it is, like, so my grandfather was in the IRA, and they took British soldiers as prisoners. This would have been in, like, the 1920s. And it was really tough on him because, this is crazy now, because this is the 1920s, so he was a rural Irish farmer who would have never heard the radio. And these dudes, the prisoners he took, they weren't officers. They were just regular British soldiers. Mm-hmm. And they were from like the East End of London or something.
Right.
And they literally couldn't understand each other. Because my granddad had never seen EastEnders and they had never heard someone from West Cork.
Yeah.
But while they were prisoners, like he just came to realize, oh, these are just poor people.
Yes.
And I'm poor people as well.
Yeah.
And they're my prisoners and I have them in the farm here and I have them for a couple of weeks and we know they might have to get executed, but we're getting along with each other and we can't really understand each other, but these people seem like me, you know? And he came to realize that, like, oh, but those officers over there, they're quite different. It's the officers, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's how I always... but why I was saying that the forces in the Second World War were radicalized. Exactly, the officers, yeah.
Yeah, like the British Army, it always did a wonderful trick by convincing the poor people of Britain that the poor people of a different country were their enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Maybe. So are you touring or anything? Are you ever in London? Or?
I just did my UK tour there. So I'll be taking a break for a while and I'll probably be back again.
Well, do
next time. Give us a shout.
Yeah, I will give you a shout.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
And say hello to your wife, because I did actually go and make that scouse.
Did you ever say, all right, the recipe?
It was fantastic. But what I loved was she almost didn't like giving me a recipe because the nature of Scouse is that there is no recipe.
Yeah.
Which I found very beautiful. I thought that was fantastic. It's like, I can give you a recipe, but you need to understand that Scouse is about whatever you have. And that was beautiful.
Well, she's a philosopher, isn't she?
Yeah.
Cook.
She is.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks, so lads. Much.
I'm going to check
Thank
out.
You. See you soon. Yeah, that was brilliant. That was amazing. Yeah, that was fantastic.
Much
Thank
love,
you.
Ryan Boy.
Oh, that was remarkable, really, wasn't it? Very different energy to me, obviously, and the podcast itself is, listening to it, it's very kind of immersive, like he says, a kind of immersive monologue, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, we tried to get a bit of advice from him in terms of podcasting, but yeah, what he does is very different to us, and the production value is incredible, the music, he makes it all himself, and I was fascinated to hear a bit about the process of how he makes that show. It really does feel very spontaneous.
Is he one that, like, where does he rank in terms of, like, is he bigger than Richard Herring? Less Adam?
It sounds like he's Adam more international. Buxton. I think Adam Buxton is always riding in the top area of podcast charts, but he doesn't release one every week like Blind Boy does.
Oh, right. Okay.
He's more like us, where, like, he releases one when there is one to release. But I think Blind Boy's up there. He told us he gets 1 million regular listeners.
Yeah.
That's mad to me.
I'd like that.
Yeah, I'd like that too. But he also talked about how important his kind of integrity and keeping it independent and relying on his listeners to help fund the show. And that's something we have in common with him. This is a truly independent production.
Yeah, because we don't have any adverts. He has the odd one.
And we fund it all ourselves. And now we are, you know, we do fund it through the Patreon, but it's not quite at a level where I can call it a full-time job. It's almost a part-time job where the income, but it is really important to the show. It gives us more working hours and more ability to reach out to guests and get nice equipment. So please help support this show, if you don't mind, dear listener, if you can afford it, of course. Head over to patreon.com/LXSLpodcast and you can donate any amount you like.
Give us some money. Yeah.
Give us a bit of cash. Help keep this show
going.
Come on. Oh, come on, give me some money.
Give me some money, please.
It does feel a bit weird doing that, but he was inspiring to hear that it's a thing to be proud of, that you're not relying on any corporations to do it. Like, you know, we do thank Audio Boom at the end of every episode, but we pay them to host the show on there because we refuse to put adverts on. And I try to put in as many hours as I can, obviously in editing and production, but also research, getting guests, social media, any sort of spreading word I can do, hooking us up gigs, but that takes a lot of time.
Yeah, really, I don't do anything.
No, but you've spent 44 years doing all...
I have, darling.
Doing all the work that you've done, which makes this podcast even worthy of listeners. But we're very grateful to everyone who does listen, of course. Don't take us wrong. But please support us, patreon.com/LXSLpodcast. And I was going to ask you a favor, Alex.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask you if I could plug something.
I could hardly say no, can I?
Well, you could, but then I would resent you. But something really cool happened to me this year, and I'd love to tell people about
it. Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Hello, Andy.
Earlier in the year, I was very proud to come second place.
You're not going to propose to me on...
No, sir.
No. All right. Isn't that a terrible thing to do, to propose to?
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't put you on the spot like that.
No, but it's an awful thing to anybody.
Why is it awful? How did...
No, not to propose, but you know, there's people who propose in front of...
On like the gigantic screen crowd and stuff. Yeah. That is... Yeah, you're really forcing someone's hand.
Yeah.
But no, that's not going to happen right now. I was just going to ask if I could tell our listeners about something I'm proud of. Earlier in the year, I came second place in the Musical Comedy Awards 2022. And that was really fun and everything. But it was also filmed by a company we spoke about last week, Next Up Comedy, which is basically Netflix for stand-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And they have just released my set on that app.
Where?
You can get it on your laptop or on your phone. And if you sign up to Next Up Comedy, I think you get like a month free or something. So even if you sign up, just watch my show and then cancel your subscription, I still think I get a little kickback from that. And cool. Also puts me in a good place with them, and maybe they'll pay me to do a special sometime. But I would really appreciate it if you guys gave it a look. Get the Next Up Comedy app.
Fucking do it.
Search for my name, Talal Karkouti, on there. That would be great.
I order you to do it. Is that too much?
No, it's not too much at all.
I order you.
Thank you, Alexei. Yes, we order you. And while we're at it, me and my brother, who is Tarbush Records, he's one half of Tarbush Records, who makes the music for this show. We do a music show on the Tarbush Records YouTube. It's called DJ Arbic. Don't judge a record by its cover. It's really fucking silly and fun. But me and my brother, basically, we listen to a record, a vinyl from front to back that neither of us have heard before. We've selected it purely on its artwork on the front cover. And then while we're listening to it, we review the album. My brother takes samples on his MPC machine. And then he makes a hip-hop beat of all the samples we took. And then I do a freestyle rap at the end of the episode. And we get a bit pissed while we do it. And it goes on YouTube, Tarbush Records, and on their Instagram. And it's a really good, fun time. Mm-hmm. And I'd love it if you guys gave that a look too.
Yeah, do it.
Oh, I've been wanting to say those two things for a while.
Yeah,
I got that out of my system.
What's the point of doing this shit if you can't plug your own?
Indeed. And if you can't, obviously, if you're not in a place to sign up to our Patreon, you know, supporting us in other ways.
Yeah, if I can do it, get your shit together.
Yeah, come on, guys.
Watch it allow.
Thank you, Alexei. And that was really fun. I hope you enjoyed chatting to Blind Boy, because I was nervous bringing you a guest. It's always nervous for me when I bring you a guest that you didn't pick. But he was great. And that was a nice chat. I could tell you two were getting on well.
Yeah.
So thanks to him. And check out his podcast. You still don't know what he looks like.
His camera turned off, didn't he?
During the Zencast he did. He said he left his bag at home, so he couldn't join us on screen, which was really sweet.
Yeah.
Integrity. All right.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. Yeah, subscribe to our Patreon account, and see you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to the Alexei Tell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.